we're helping protect our patients. We're moving that needle, but we work really hard to do it in a way where we're stewarding the money that's given to us. Because every dollar we spend on security is a dollar we're not spending on healthcare. Again, we're a not-for-profit community-based hospital. The job of Northside is not to be secure. The job of Northside is to deliver care in the communities that we're located. So by living that and living the patient safety model, I think we've been really successful.
From ExitBeam, this is the new CISO, a show about the people who lead IT security teams, the challenges they face, and how they overcome them. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, and subscribe to hear our new episodes first. I'm Steve Moore, and today I speak with Martin Fisher, CISO at Northside Hospital. Martin is a husband, father, Army veteran, woodworker, tabletop gamer, and former podcast host. But when it comes to security, he's a leader that values authenticity and patient safety above all else. He joins us today to share his approach to managing mental health and building unified teams as a CISO. A CISO's bad day factor causes stress that can affect themselves, their teams, and even their families. That said, what should security leaders prioritize at work and at home? Why is a shared team culture so important? And how can CISOs show their broader organization that security is more than just a cost center? Martin, thank you so much for being on our show today. For the uninitiated, if you would, please introduce yourself.
Hey, glad to be here. I'm Martin Fisher. I am the CISO for Northside Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. Been in this role for about 9 years. Overall, my tech career is over 25 years, so I'm kind of dating myself a bit. And I've been doing security now for the last 12, 13 years in healthcare, financial services, and commercial aviation.
Interesting. You are the only guest we've had. Well, I take that back. We had one other guest who also was a podcaster. You're no longer active, but tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, the Southern Fried Security Podcast was 10 years of beautiful toil. It was in the earlier days of security podcasting, and Andy Willingham, Yvette Johnson, and Steve Reagan, and we had so much, and Joseph Sokoli, I cannot forget him. We had so much fun doing it, but there comes a time in any, project that it was like, we'd said all the things we needed to say, and we gracefully closed it down. But it was a fantastic experience.
There were several of you involved, but I think it's enough of a differentiator to explore for a little bit, because we don't have really of the 85, 86, 87 CISOs I've interviewed, you are number two. What do you think you've learned the most out of doing a podcast? Like, was there a recognition of something looking back, since it's been a while, where you said, hey, I gained something? Yeah, what might that be?
Because I did most of the post-production and editing, and I began to realize that I was using way too much jargon, and I was using way too much inside baseball talk to really effectively communicate. Because I would ask, friends who were not security people to listen to it, and they're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. So it forced me to, and I think it's really helped me as I moved on through my roles, to really effectively communicate security from the information security, cybersecurity perspective to non-technologists, to people who are in the business, because that's important because they control your budget. And if you can't explain to them effectively what you need to do, and if you can't sell the service you're providing, you're not going to get the funding. So I think that's probably the number one thing I got out of it.
That's a really good observation and really a lesson for all of us. I think, great leaders are great simplifiers, and having to go through and listen to yourself or others, but especially yourself, you have the opportunity to reflect a bit and say, how could I have said that a little more cleanly? The same goes for writing. For those of you that you might write an email that's 3 or 4 paragraphs long, and by the time you edit it, maybe half as much or maybe even one paragraph. And I think as you go up in the ranks, that's a really important skill. And I like that was your answer. Having to go back and listen to yourself in general, though, is just painful.
Oh, intensely. It's intensely painful.
And I think that may be another product of what we're talking about here. For those of you that ever had to watch yourself on video, I almost refuse to do it, but it's the same sort of thing. You're listening to yourself explain and explore a topic, and it's a great learning tool. And I wonder, for me, this sounds a little silly, but doing a podcast for me, if I had to answer the same question, being the one that's not at the center, you know, I now do a lot of public speaking, but this show is about the guest. Knowing how to be a good interviewer is a skill in and of itself as well, right? It's not easy. I mean, you might not know how to explore that. How do I learn more about Martin, which is the whole purpose of this show, right? So that's the thing, that becoming a good interviewer, I think, is another thing for me. So beyond the podcast, I think it's also interesting to talk about other hobbies. You have a creative side with tabletop games and also woodworking. Talk a little bit about that. I think that's good for the listener to kind of figure out who else is Martin.
Yeah, so I grew up in the beginning ages of Dungeons and Dragons and just glommed onto it. I was a nerd, an OG nerd. So for me, you know, I fell in love with tabletop role-playing games. And then, you know, I had kids, kind of fell out of it for a couple of decades. And over the last 6, 8, 10 years, I've gotten back into it. And boy, there's some fantastic stuff out there. So I still play, you know, D&D, but I also play Call of Cthulhu. I play Pathfinder. I back so many Kickstarters for tabletop role-playing games. I'm frantically waiting for my Cowboy Bebop role-playing game to come in. So yeah, it's I've got a great circle of friends, and it's a fantastic way. And especially even during COVID, you know, there were enough virtual tabletop systems where we could keep our games going and still be safe. On the woodworking side, this is probably my second attempt to get good at it. I enjoy just being able to disassociate and focus on building a thing. If it's a box or a chair or, you know, an appliance for inside my shop, the ability to take wood and metal and with effort make something useful. Because a lot of times I think in security, we build things and either they're never done, right? Or you never get to see the actual benefit. A lot of times when we deploy stuff in security, we hope we actually never have to use it. Versus building something. And a lot of times the stuff we build in security is not pretty. A lot of it is just, let's be honest, these consoles are really ugly. So building something pretty, building something that, you know, my wife or my kids or my friends will enjoy using, that is therapeutic for me.
That's where I was headed with the line of questions. So, and it has persistence. You didn't say this, but that thing that you make has persistence beyond the electronic world. I think that's a different, I think there's a split there. And that I think, just as a theme, one of the things that's important for us to cover on the show in general, the reason why we have leaders on the show to talk about themselves and about their career and their journey is for this very reason. How do you cope with the stress of the position? And we've heard a handful of ways that you've done this, both, you know, wanting to work with your hands, looking for an element of persistence. I think that's important. And I think tabletop games too, the element of creativity. I think there's an element of problem solving that's key to our position, even in an executive form, that's important. And you sounds like you're of the age where, you know, you also might not have had a console game to explore. You might have had to build your own.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I mean, as we talk about how to deal with the stress. So I work for a hospital system. And just to be really clear with folks out there, because this is a topic, you know, that we don't talk about a lot, but we need to, is that mental health care is health care. Therapy is a hugely important thing. Having someone that you can go out to and talk through your stress. I mean, especially if you think about what's been going on in the world, I was a hospital CISO during a pandemic. And I've been using various mental health services, and a lot of people don't ever want to say that, but I've got to be able to support what I do for a living. I believe in what the mission of what Northside does. You know, we're a not-for-profit community-based hospital system. Mental health care is health care. So if I can't advocate for that, I just would feel awful.
So if you would spend a second on your view of that mental health, the reason why I ask is, if you look across this profession, high degree of, I've talked about this on the show before, but mental health issues, substance abuse, divorce, heart attacks, strokes, you know, health, stress-related health problems. And I could go on and on. Okay, we are still a relatively new profession, but it's our bad day factor is very high and it's not getting better. Even I'd argue with some additional maturity, we've not figured out a way to manage this any better. So with that setup, maybe a bit a gloomy one, how do you approach that? How does Martin, in the way that he can for himself and maybe the team, if you want to cover that, how do you manage that?
It's hard. I think the biggest thing for me, and this is something that I've learned through therapy, and it's still a work in progress, is you've got to be able to set boundaries. I think a lot of the folks that we see in the community who get crushed by what's going on either can't, don't, or won't set a boundary that says my work, my profession, my career goes this far and no farther. From this point afterwards, I'm going to do a different thing. And they never give themselves a time to decompress. And I think, especially as you start moving into positions of managerial and then executive leadership, those of us who get there, I think the selection process favors people who are willing to sacrifice themselves to serve the organization. And that's a good thing on the whole, but any strength over time can become a devastating weakness. Add to that, basing this on a series of anecdotes, not data, but as I've gone through my career, my observation is that there's a higher number of neurodivergent people in IT as compared to the general population. Then if you look at security, it's an even higher percentage of neurodivergent people than are in IT. And that's not a bad thing. It's an observation, but I think as I talk, do my internal self-talk, and I talk with friends and peers and people on the team, again, my observation is that neurodivergent folks seem to have a tougher time sometimes dealing with the stress, or they look like they're dealing really, really well, but they don't have a gradual descent. They crater immediately. And that's a challenge, right? So for me, fortunately, my wife is extremely good at holding me accountable to doing the thing, you know, keeping the boundaries set and keeping my commitments around, you know, my therapy appointments and the check-ins that we do, you know, a couple, three times a week. So that's what's gotten me through the last 3 years. But with my folks, I think as leaders, we need to, you know, most organizations, especially those of any size, have an employee assistance program where, you know, there's a company that can take that employee's call, route them to a behavioral health service that is going to help them get through it. And it's completely anonymous. The companies will usually say, you know, 4 of your employees called. There's no demographics. So we have to provide those safe ways for the folks on our team to engage the services they may desperately need. And that's how we try to fix it.
One way, and I don't know if it's intentional or not, or if you just chose not to include it, or maybe just by virtue of the fact you're on the podcast talking about it, I think that's an amazing step in the direction. If you're going to be an advocate and discuss what we're chatting about right now, sharing with others, including your staff, that you make use of these resources, is that sharing that sensitive topic, or what is often considered a sensitive topic, with your team is a fantastic first start.
Absolutely. It builds credibility. It says, look, you know, we're all in this together, right? And, you know, I've shared in all hands with my folks, you know, not to any level of detail, kind of like what I'm sharing here, that this is what I'm doing. And I this is what I've gotten out of it. And I want that same benefit for you. But, and this is an important thing, I've got my employee relations people speaking in my head. You can broadcast all that you want, but you can't ask for a return information. Now, it's offered. If you have a relationship with a direct or a relationship with a skip where they're willing to talk about that with you in a one-on-one or whatever, one, awesome job, leader. Two, the level of confidentiality and privacy that demands is tremendous. And so never, never, ever lose my, you can always share your story. You're not allowed to share other people's without their permission.
You know, it's interesting. You talked about kind of the spectrum of people that you'd have in IT or IT security. There is a connection to mission that's extremely strong in our industry. And I started off in IT and then moved over fairly early into as an intrusion analyst, you know, later on, but it's still early in my career. But the level of the amount of pain that people are willing to endure of no sleep, no time off, don't take vacation, always available by phone. But those are the ingredients. That's almost the expectation, even though that it's absurd, but that's also rewarded too. I mean, that's sort of the thing that so we are selecting people that are most willing to harm themselves. And a little bit of that sacrifice is good, which you alluded to, but that strength, using your words, will ultimately be a weakness. You can develop these very unhealthy situations. And the people who pay the price are the people at home, generally.
The blast radius of that problem is huge. And as leaders, a lot of times we don't see it because those people who are generally experiencing those problems are not, or may not be aware of what they're doing at home. And two, if they do, most likely they're not willing to talk about it until it's way too late.
Right. Right. It's not an easy thing. So first off, I applaud you for sharing. For those listening, it wasn't necessarily something we were even going to cover. It wasn't even in my notes, but I'm glad that it was brought up and shared. I think it's a wonderful thing for a leader to share, and it's an element of credibility. And I think also, I had someone tell me a long time ago that you should put your weaknesses on the table sort of strategically. So if you put them there, no one else can use them against you, right? You've sort of put them out there, and it's almost a form of strength.
Yeah, I think it can be, but for me, it's more, I think when it comes to building relationships, you have to be your authentic self. Inauthentic people can build a quick relationship, but it's not going to last. And also, when you have people who are having authentic relationships together, the level of community and productivity just skyrockets. And the level of stress inside that group can come way down. And so to me, it's win-win-win. Which is why, as I look at people to promote into leadership on the team, we look for those authentic people.
Absolutely. And I think that if staff believe that you're authentic, and there's many facets to this, but if they believe that you actually give a damn about them as a human, they will do amazing things for the program. They'll actually work better. They feel safer. They're not as, often we work in big companies that are very political and sometimes a bit scary, but if they feel like they've got a leader who stands behind them, many of those fears kind of melt away, and you get a very high trust, high speed team as a result.
With a lot less drama.
Right, right, right. So I want to take us back a little bit. You said you've been with your current employer for 9 years, and you were the first full-time security person. So you, by default, you were it, and now you've grown the team. Talk to us a little bit about that opportunity, and you're the first one in, and now you're the CISO. What's that journey like? 9 years ago, you go in. How'd that begin? Tell us the genesis of that.
So it started, a bad thing happened. Like, most of these kinds of stories, a bad thing happened, and, Northside realized they hadn't been paying attention to information security. And I was, leaving another hospital and came in and interviewed, and it just immediately, the cultural personality of Northside and mine, it was really clear there was going to be a really good connection. And it was sort of the classic dear podcast. I never thought it would happen to me. I'm a CISO in a company that has budget and executive support and a corporate culture that uptakes security really, really well. And there was a lot to do, but again, it was one of those things where the first 3 years went by in just a blink of an eye, but we started moving the needle, and we started adding folks. We're currently at 26 people. We're probably going to be adding another 8 over the next 6 to 12 months as we continue to grow additional capabilities and continue to mature the program. Because security is one of those things where, because of the way we've built the program and the way I've managed to talk about the program in terms of patient safety and in terms of quality of care, the organization understands the investment. I mean, when you do what I do for a living and your CFO in a meeting with their peer group calls your program an investment and not a cost center, that's winning, right? And that's not personally. It's that we're doing a good thing for the hospital. We're helping protect our patients. We're moving that needle, but we work really hard to do it in a way where we're stewarding the money that's given to us. Because every dollar we spend on security is a dollar we're not spending on healthcare. Again, we're a not-for-profit community-based hospital. The job of Northside is not to be secure. The job of Northside is to deliver care in the communities that we're located. So by living that and living the patient safety model, I think we've been really successful. And I've got a group of folks out there who, you know, as we hired people in, you know, when I'm teaching, you know, my subordinate leaders how to hire and what we're hiring for, my 4-hour talk boils down to one expression. If we have a candidate who doesn't have 100% the right skill set or doesn't have 100% the right experience, we can get them training and we can give them opportunities. But if their mama didn't raise them right, we don't have the time, inclination, or energy to help them. So we hire for org fit in a way that's pretty unusual, but it's in a way that if you are a certain personality and your personality is 90 to 180 degrees different from the organization you're in, you're going to be unhappy. No matter how good you are, no matter how much they pay you, you're going to be unhappy. And unhappy people make more unhappy people. They really do. So we work really hard to hire people who get what we're trying to do. It's been a really good experience. We do a lot of hiring from other elements of IT. Several of our most recent hires have been folks that came out of sort of the endpoint support teams, you know, the field services teams that are out there. And it's been fantastic. So I could talk for hours about my team and how proud of I am.
Well, we'll get there. Let's talk for a second about description of mission. I think this is something that's important, and maybe it's easier, or maybe it's more difficult in a provider setting, but you said to me flat out that, you know, you're there because the hospital, and therefore you are there because someone is sick or injured, and patient safety is then number one, which you certainly alluded to. You said something that's interesting, though, that you flip the CIA triad. What did you mean when you said that? Explain that.
The way I usually talk about this is, you know, when you're in my hospital, you're not here to sleep in my bed, eat my food, or wear my clothes. You are here because you or someone you care about is injured or sick, and our job as a hospital is to provide effective medical care so they can go back home. The worst thing I can do in my program is hurt you when you are in my hospital. So if you think about the way, and I'm talking more the acute setting, right? The inpatient setting. I've got 67,000 endpoints out there. Half to two thirds are medical devices. I cannot get in the way of those medical devices being used. We have a special care nursery that has some of the most fragile patients in our environment in there. And they're surrounded by, I think there's 23 devices in each bassinet. Yeah, we are going to do everything we can to protect that. The devices have to be available. The telemetry systems have to be available. So we fight for availability. Well, the next most important thing to us is, hey, if the doctor is going into the EMR or the MA is going in to check your allergies, the integrity of that data that, hey, if you're allergic to penicillin, and it's not in there, and they give you a shot of penicillin, anaphylaxis is a bad thing, right? So that's the next most important thing. Confidentiality, you know what? It's a bad day if your medical information gets breached. That's not going to hurt you. It's not going to physically harm you. You're going to get some free credit monitoring and assurances that we take the privacy of your information very seriously, yada, yada, yada. But that's, when it comes down to a patient safety focused environment, and it's a life safety environment, confidentiality is third. It has to be. And we actually use that during the interview process, because a lot of times when we're interviewing someone from outside, they've not been in a healthcare delivery organization before. And especially early when I was interviewing a lot of individual contributors, I would ask them, hey, what do you think as this CISO, what do you think I worry about? And usually they would, you know, put on their face and say, well, you're going to be worried about credit cards getting stolen or, you know, protected health information exiting. And I would listen to their answer and listen for the quality of what their answer was. But I say, okay, that's interesting. And I would essentially share what I just did. Hey, what about biomedical devices and, you know, radiation oncology devices and the fact that people are counting on us being able to do that? And that whole question answer statement was to watch their expression as they processed that, and did they get it? And if they didn't, at that point, the interview is more or less over because you're not going to get why we're here. But if the person could, you could see them pivot and go, I never thought about it that way, but that makes sense. All right. That's the first big hurdle to making it onto the team. And it, again, it kind of shows as if you were to walk around and talk to my folks, they get it.
Well, yeah, Martin, explain that a little bit more for the listener who might not work on the provider side and may not have picked up what you just explained there. The interviewer, it's not wrong to give the wrong answer. It's only, quote unquote, wrong to not have the response after gaining new information.
That's a great question, Steve. So I think for me, it's if you are asking people about things that are outside of their experience and it's not reasonable for them to know the right answer, I think as an interviewer and as someone who's evaluating people, I listen to the quality of their answer. It does what a lay person knows about how a hospital works, does that make sense? Right? Okay. But now, intelligent security person, I'm going to present you with some new facts and some new information that I want to watch how you respond to it. And most times, people, they get it. You've shown a light in a corner they've never seen before, and they're on board. Occasionally, you will get people who are like, no. The medical records are the most important thing. You can't, those, all right. I'm not going to argue with you, but thanks very much. And I think kind of getting back to Steve, what you were asking about, I think it's important for us as interviewers and as people who are evaluating people, you don't want to necessarily ding someone for not having a specific experience or understanding your specific culture. But what you can do is feed them enough information and give them enough context clues to see if they get it. And that's the key.
So this kind of dovetails a little bit into, you know, you talked about people with, if they lacked a skill, that was okay. You can sort of train that in. But if they weren't raised right, there's no time to fix that, or you're not going to put the effort into that, which is a cultural fit topic. I guess the first thing you have to do is, before you can do any of that, you have to define your own culture. So talk to us a little bit about that, on the exercise of defining your, because every culture is a little different, right? If you and I went in to get a job in banking in New York, very different vibe. And it's just different, right? There's a different set of expectations. There's a different speed, probably. There's different motivations and incentives. So with this, though, I mean, you haven't talked about it necessarily, but before you can evaluate on cultural fit, you've got a cleanly defined culture. And when you're the first security person, and now you're at 26, getting ready to hire 8 more, and now you're the CISO, it's on you to build that, or at least and align it to the mission and the culture of your employer. So define that a little bit on how to, because some people may be listening and thinking, hey, this all sounds great. I don't even know if I have a rubric for my own culture on what I'm trying to hire for. So how in the hell am I going to balance one from the other when I'm interviewing? So unpack that for us a little bit, if you would.
Let me tell you what I did. And it was a very deliberate choice. And I will not take credit for inventing this. I had a mentor who really helped me understand that this is what we needed to do. But I looked at the North side, you know, every organization has a mission statement, and North side, we have service standards. But within the service standards, we use very specific words to describe what we do. You know, we are service oriented. We are kind. We are, I mean, so Northside describes its culture in ways that are directly relatable to the kind of people you want to hire. And because of my focus on patient safety, what I did is I went to our quality and safety department and started looking at the way they talk about what it is they do, because our quality and safety folks are amazing. They're just amazing people. So instead, what I did, I kind of cheated. I didn't necessarily invent a culture for me. I borrowed the vocabulary and the messaging from our quality and safety people and just put a security spin on it. I describe what we do as we support the caregivers to deliver safe care. So our job is to protect these devices. Our job is to protect the network. And, and this is why we do what we do. It's about patient safety, quality of care. Patient safety, quality of care. And I think as we continue to grow the team, I think it's hard sometimes, when you're bringing on people who report to somebody, who report to somebody, who reports to somebody, who reports to you. One of my biggest jobs is being that evangelist of what that culture is and constantly talking about patient safety, constantly talking about quality of care and making sure that we're aligned on it. And I think for me, what's also helped build credibility of the program inside the organization is because I use the same vocabulary and it means the same thing when I go talk to the head of our emergency department, or if I go talk to a charge nurse in on a med-surg floor, and I'm using that vocabulary and the communications and the education they're getting from security reflects what safety is doing, we have a lot more credibility and people see us as trying to help them versus inflict the program on them. And then you start getting into this very positive feedback loop where you're growing and you're building and you're more and more aligned and you're more and more close to the key culture of the organization. It takes a lot of friction out, which is really at the end of the day what we want.
Absolutely. I think that makes a lot of sense, especially on the friction point. And I think in many times, as they say, the highest form of flattery is just copying something that's, if you know that it's good and it works and you've worked to sort of translate that into the security program, but in a way that works well for the provider environment, which notoriously, I'll say, from my own personal experience, professional experience, you will see a lot of security teams fail very fast in a hospital setting because of this formula that they try to flip their own formula, meaning they don't flip the triad. They're trying to force security for security's sake, and they don't get funding. They have problems, and it's just a different, I think it could be one of the most difficult environments, I've often said, to work if you don't have someone who can translate the way that you've articulated here. Do you think, though, and this is not meant to be a fastball question, but in the process of flipping the triad, is it then more okay to have a security incident? Culturally, because of all of what you've described, is it more okay to have a ransomware event or email compromise or some insider threat? Is that more okay, and is the culture more okay with that?
Part of me saying that's a really unfair question, Steve, but it's not. It's an eminently fair one. So it depends. And again, it goes like 99% of what we talk about in security. It depends. A ransomware event, yeah, no, because that's going to impact the availability of systems. If you ransomware my PAX environment, or if you ransomware, a control system for biomed, you've just taken devices out. So out of all the things that from a security incident perspective that I worry about the most, it's ransomware. And we've invested a lot of time and energy making ourselves more resilient and getting more proactive about it. Other incidents, stuff happens in our world. And I think the organization, I get a little bit of grace. Is probably the way I'd phrase it. It's never okay, right? Because something has failed, but we fail. We're human. So we've never touched some wood object, had a major incident at the hospital while I've been here, but it could happen. And I know that in my role, if something sufficiently bad happens, I will be thanked for my efforts, right? And whoever succeeds me will probably have more budget. But that's not the default way Northside works. I think for me, we've built a program to where we are very candid and pragmatic with our steering committee. We let them know things are going to happen. And, you know, this is where we dodged a bullet. Hey, this is where a small thing happened. We contained it. We got rid of it. Here was the outcome. Especially as you start looking now at things, and this was out there in the public, so I can talk about it. You know, Northside was targeted by Killnet weeks ago, part of a demonstration of DDoS against the U.S. is, you know, because, you know, the U.S. is supporting Ukraine. And yeah, our website took a hit for a while, and we got through it. And, you know, we had conversations with senior leadership, and we're good, right? I never felt that I was being career challenged there. But again, it's that alignment that says, you know, we're going to work together. And I know that if I need help, I can reach out to my CFO or I can reach out to my COO and go, hey, this thing is happening. Here's the potential impact to care delivery. I need these three things. Can you help me? And those things are always made available. And I'm not saying that every organization can do that. I'm incredibly lucky. I'm incredibly privileged to be in the role I'm in the organization I'm in. And I work really hard to try to not forget that, but sometimes you do start taking things for granted.
Sure. You mentioned, you know, you're in 9 years-ish. You said there hasn't been a major incident, but you and I were talking about crisis and incident management and something I've spent a lot of my career doing. And the question I asked you is, do you need a crisis to kind of set the tone in order to oftentimes to make big change? Your answer was yes. And why?
It's yes and, right? So yes, I mean, that's why I'm here, right? A crisis happened and they found they needed someone to come in and make sure that didn't happen again. But I also think, and this is something that within the, I think more companies, again, if you've got to have the credibility inside the organization, but I use cautionary tales a lot, right? Similarly positioned folks that, you know, hey, this bad thing happened over there. If that same event was to happen here, here's most likely what would or would not happen. There's a fine line between that and fear, uncertainty, and doubt, right? There's a line there where I don't ever want to be in FUD, but I do believe that you can use cautionary tales and very pragmatically talk about what happened and essentially run that little mini tabletop on your whiteboard. Because remember, the business of a hospital is not to be secure. So they're just not going to automatically stop and think, well, nothing's really happened on the security side. Maybe we should throw more money at it. That's never going to happen. It takes an interrupt action for administration, for leadership to pause and go, we don't want that to happen again. Or if it's a cautionary tale, we don't want that happening to us. What do we need to do? And that's really the only way change happens. I mean, an object in motion will stay in motion unless a force acts on it. And it's incidents and crises that are the force that acts on the program.
Yeah, that's a good way of phrasing it. I want to ask also, one of the things we cover often, one of my favorite questions just in general, is what's the worst career advice you've ever received?
Gosh. Oh, there's been so much of it. I think initially, yeah, and we had talked about you were going to pose this. I think for me, it was go work for a hedge fund. That was just, I was not a good fit. And I tried to force myself to fit. It ended gloriously badly. So yeah, again, that gets to the whole, you know, being your authentic self. There are some people who survived at that place for a long time and did really good work. I was not one of them.
You know, one of the things also you talked about, so you were in service, you were in the Army, and we talked a bit about incident response. I think this is an important thing. It's an attribute that I talk about when I speak about sort of executive incident response, incident management, that the subjects of comfort and confidence in the organization must see both in you. But you mentioned how that helped you manage your time in service, helped you manage IR, about not getting excited, staying calm. tell us a little bit about that. How did you take that Army experience, and what do you think you apply most from that? And as you share that, it's really is, you know, what should people be doing when they're thinking about IR as a learning tool via the podcast, right?
So briefly, my military service, I enlisted, I was a 19 kilo M1 armored crewman, did one station unit training at Fort Knox, Kentucky, with all the fun associated with that. Did ROTC, was commissioned as an armor officer, and did my armor officer basic course again at beautiful Fort Knox, Kentucky. And when you do basic training, you're exposed things to what is lovingly called the mask confidence exercise, where you're wearing a protective mask in a small room, overly saturated with CS tear gas, and your drill sergeant looks at you and instructs you to remove your mask. And it is one of the worst days of your life. And there are things that you learn to do in the military that really no day in security is likely to ever be that bad. So I've done stuff in my life that what's happening here today in this incident response, I've been through worse, right? So there's a level of self-confidence there. But I also think in becoming an officer and learning the Army method of leadership, that idea of being the quiet, confident, follow me person, the reason they teach that is because as human beings, we are attracted to that. You know, I had a boss at the airline, and her thing was, you know, during an incident response or during a crisis, you can't scare the kids, right? If you just think about it, if you're working in an environment and the person who's in charge is clearly and obviously distraught or struggling or is lacking confidence, all of a sudden you're wondering, what the heck am I doing here? Versus working with someone who's competent and confident. And even if they make a bad choice, they're like, you know what? We're going to change what we're doing. This isn't working the way I wanted it to. We're going to pivot and go this way. All right. Are we together? Let's go. And that, to me, again, it reduces the friction inside of an incident response. It makes people more confident, more willing, and especially if you use, I mean, the Army, you know, is this idea of empowering people to perform the mission, the commander's intent. You know, if you walk into an IR and you're like, you have a group of folks, hey guys, we need to find out where this malware came from and what is it doing? And hey, Susie, I need you to run with that. Get back to me in an hour. All right. The next thing we need to do is X. And you empower people. You tell them what needs to be done. You don't tell them specifically how to do it, because if you need to tell them how to do it, they shouldn't be there. And I think sometimes, especially if you were a leader who came up from the trenches, right? And I think some of them who are very technical sometimes have a difficult time. And it's not malicious. It's just they've never thought through, let people accomplish the tasks. My job as an executive is to tell people what the outcome needs to be, or what the deliverable needs to be. And then if they may come back and go, hey, in order to do that, I need these two things, then my job becomes getting them those two things. And I think when you start getting into that cycle of, you know, having your technical folks know what the expectation is, know what they need to do, and then you are accountable for getting them what they need, the tension in that incident response can come way, way down. And people can be focused on rapid recovery. And that's what we're there for. And that's the power of hiring the right people across all the levels of the team.
Oh, it's such a great thing to see. You know, not everything is crisis time, but when there's a crisis, to have people that you can count on and give instruction to, and not explain how to do it, just say, this is what needs to, I need you to run with this. And also people that won't wilt when you say, hey, I need you to do this, call me if there's any problems, but don't come back until it's done, kind of thing. And I'm not saying that in a mean way, just come back when it's complete, but don't come back until it's done, right? Clear, and it's boom, done. And that's the best. That's why I personally love breach response, incident management, crisis management, because things are the clearest they will ever be right then. Some people, it's unclear. To me, everything is extremely clear. It's extremely clear what it is we need to do. It's extremely clear who's adding value and who's not. It's extremely clear who I can count on. I think crisis, you don't want to operate that way. You don't want to be an adrenaline junkie. That's no way to live. But I absolutely love it.
Absolutely, because I mean, because your goal is so much closer to you. When you're developing a security program, your goals are 12, 18, 24 months out. So the immediacy is not there. But when you're in an incident response and you're wanting to make sure that the network doesn't fall over in the next 15 minutes, a ticking clock is a really, it's a lens that helps you focus on what has to happen right now. And your point's exactly right. The level of clarity, if you allow yourself to have it, right? And as a leader, our job is to kind of take a step back and a step up, look a little bit farther than our folks and pick that point on the horizon and say, we are going there and we are going there right now. Let's move out is key.
It's so we're getting a little bit short on time. I've got a handful of questions more though. First off, so I was not in service. My father was, but describe for those listening, you referenced something that I think it'd be good for the listeners to understand. What is commander's intent?
Commander's intent is a description on the part of the commander as to what the outcome is. So for example, you see this a lot if you watch Navy movies, anything having to do with the submarine, where the captain of the submarine will go, attention on deck. It is my intention is to approach the target vessel from this angle and fire a salvo of three torpedoes, resulting in the sinking of the vessel, right? You describe an outcome. Echo Troop, you know, advances at 8 o'clock in the morning as a movement to contact or a screening operation. What has to be done? Because here's the thing, that plan, however well it was laid out, is not going to survive contact with the enemy. Things are going to change. So if you have good people on your team who can, hey, the boss said, we're doing this for this reason, I get that. The bad guy is not responding the way we thought he was. So I'm going to change what I'm doing to keep trying to accomplish what my boss wants. By laying out a vision of what Nirvana looks like is commander's intent. And if you have good people who are motivated, they will help get you there with a lot less direct supervision. And also, it also has the side benefit of if you have the right people on your team and you tell them, this is where we need to be. This is where we need to go. Implicit or explicit, you're saying, and I trust your skills to get us there. And sometimes there are times explicitly, like, hey, y'all, I trust you to get us where we need to go because I got to turn around now and go brief whoever. Ping me if you need anything. You know what you need to do. Now go do it. That's how you build a team.
So I think that's an excellent operating model. It keeps you from micromanaging. It instills trust over time. And the way I would distill that commander's intent based on your description is it's a little bit of the what we're going to do, maybe a little bit of the why, but never the how. Perfect. We are just at time. I've got one more question for you. We close every show on this and pursuant to the name of the show, the new CISO. Martin, tell us, what does being a new CISO mean to you?
It was the most gratifying, scary, valuable role I've ever had. And I'm doing it in a place that I believe in our mission. I believe in what we do. We have some of the best caregivers, I think, in the world in this organization. And as that new CISO, it's a privilege and an honor and a little bit terrifying to help protect them and our patients.
Perfect. Martin, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks for asking.
That is it for this episode of the new CISO. Thank you for listening. Check out more episodes on xbeam.com/podcast. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe to get brand new episodes first.